Blog Talk Radio.
Comes with souls, blessings and greetings and blessings. We're alive because we're blessed to stay alive right now in Torah Chaim, instructors of life, Torah Chesed, instructors of kindness, Torah Rachamim, instructors of mercies. You're now tuned into blogtalkradio.com, and we humbly suggest we are the higher frequency embedded within blogtalkradio.com. We call ourselves Soul Class. This is Soul Class 534, in search of ancient authentic Torah. Program presentation number 127, Baruch Hashem, blessed is our Creator, Shalom, peace, and bracha, blessing upon the human family experience. With Creator's help, we're broadcasting right now live. It's about, about 9:32, 9:33 Eastern Standard Time, live from Turtle Island, a.k.a. the USA, Unifying Souls Actually. Program content will focus on the following topics for discussion. Genesis chapter 7, verse 3. Proverbs chapter 3, verse 25. Teachings from the Nesher Gadol, the great eagle Rambam, Brezov / Chabad Hasidus, and reading from an exciting new book, The Theory and Practice of Universal Ethics, the Noahad Laws, written by Rabbi Dr. Shimon David Cowan, which can be purchased by going to the following link, http://another/store.kehotonline.com/prodinfo.asp?number=EL-THEO. Our calling number right now if you want to participate or hear the your smartphone, whatever app you might have to be able to access our program, is 347-838-8669. Meanwhile, may the Eternal Creator bless and protect you and your loved ones, please, peacefully and pleasantly. And just to give you an idea of what we're tagging our show with, in terms of our envision to continue to share such content, is Divine Creator, Divine Image, Torah Bible Class, Universal Redemption, Children of Israel and the Children of Noah, meditating upon eliminating hatred, jealousy, and competition, which is unwarranted. The 613 Commandments, the 7 Universal Core Commandments, Chassidus, Israelite written and oral Torah traditions. But in order to get on with the shoe, we've got to be able to actually ask forgiveness from Rabbi Isaac Piton, whose music we're playing right now. Here's Him Come the Time from his Generation Redemption. But so without further ado, we got to turn down the music. Sorry, Rabbi Isaac. Oy vey. And just remind everyone, if you happen to be in the Crown House section of Brooklyn this coming Shabbat, that should be the 9th of Kislev, 5,776 years blazing and grazing creations into original man and woman, were blessed to be the initial stewards of the human family experience of Isaac Piton's Beit Mazal. He's the president of the congregation under the spiritual leadership of Rabbi Daniel Mapur. The Prayers start at 10 a.m. with the help of the Most High. The location of the congregation, Beit Mazal, is 1433 President Street, Crown Heights section of Brooklyn, located between Albany Avenue and Kingston Avenue. And there you can hear, if you merit to come, and we will merit to participate as well, to hear authentic Jewish, Moroccan, North African chanting to classical ancient Israelite prayer liturgy. Joining me on today's program is none other than our Rambam activist and teacher and student and advocate for the dissemination of the teachings of the Nesher Gadol, the Great Eagle, Rambam, Maimonides, Rabbi Moshe Ben Maimon, Dennis Ryan. Good morning, sir.
Boker Tov, Don, and to everybody's listening.
Okay. Actually, I was a little derelict in my duties in terms of bringing out a letter to share with you, as we are accustomed in this program format, this program presentation, to glean out and pluck an inspiration from a letter from the Lubavitcher Rebbe, responding as he did for well over 50 years, 60 years, to followers, students, devotees, and those who were not directly his disciples, those who just had questions in matters of Torah. So I have another a book that I'm going to pull out. So usually I pull from Chabad.org. So let's just pull something right out of the air here, and let's see what we can discuss. Hold on, please. In fact, one second, please. Okay, now we took care of that logistical matter. Okay, we have a letter that the Rebbe wrote to someone about the perplexed. And I know Dennis likes to read from the Guide to Perplexed. So here's something that the Rebbe addressed to a young woman living in Boston, Massachusetts. The year is not given when this letter was written. Let's pluck out something to share with you. So the Rebbe addressed this woman's letter, saying that you write and do not always find the right answers to the questions put to you in various matters concerning Judaic teachings. Needless to say, you should not feel discouraged by this, insomuch as even veteran scholars who engage in the study of Torah for many, many years cannot always answer all the questions. This is not surprising, insomuch as a human being is a created being and cannot possibly understand the wisdom of the Creator. However, even if one does not know all the answers, it doesn't have to influence in the least, God forbid, what one does understand of the Torah, the biblical teachings, and the observance of the commandments, and which are also known as the mitzvahs. If you look into a thing more carefully, you will realize that most of those who challenge you with questions are not really interested in the truth, but only seek justification for themselves and their conduct, both in the eyes of others as well as in their own. Their conscience is bothering them for having abandoned the way of life of their ancestors throughout the generations. Many of their ancestors who actually gave up their lives for the sake of maintaining our heritage, whereas they themselves have recklessly and differently exchanged their obligations and spiritual treasures for the less refined material comforts of life. So, with that being said, Dennis, I'll turn to you. Yes, there. Many I've seen this many times. People have burning questions, but many of those burning questions came from point A. They don't have the patience to do the research. Point B, as they're looking to challenge what may seem overwhelming to them, an infringement of their current style or lifestyle, and as well that something is bothering them, and they don't understand that many people who came before them in prior generations were willing to make great sacrifices for the continuance of their generations. And therefore, this person who comes to this level of understanding, or I would say a constricted level of understanding or consciousness, they start to generate questions, looking for the right answers that will justify their own continuance of their lifestyle, which will paradoxically continue to create within them a subconscious feeling of anxiety because they know they're not on a balanced, steady path of following the Creator, adhering to what is the basic standards for human decency, and fellowshipping with other people. So what's your take on these matters?
Well, There are no humans that are perfect, so therefore there are
right.
nobody. There is nobody on Earth knows everything. So
right.
you cannot raise your expectations that you're going to get a complete answer to every question you have, because part of the problem is you. And that is, when you ask a question, you are motivated by something to ask the question. So since the person who hears the question doesn't know what your motivation is, they have to take the words that you use to frame the question. So they do the best they can. It may not satisfy you, but they are doing their best. So since you know there is nobody that knows everything, so we don't really go about asking questions with the understanding or expectation you're going to hear 100% correct answer that will satisfy you. No, you will hear another human telling you what the best thing they can to help you to understand what they believe was your motivation for the question.
Nice point, Dennis. And also, I will say this too, that one of the things that after a certain talk was delivered by the Rebbe, he was very pleased in the process of those who recorded his teaching, whether he spoke on Shabbos, where you can't literally write at the moment he spoke, according to our tradition of how to keep the Sabbath, or during the week when there were access to tape recorders. He was very pleased when people would, in fact, annotate his talk with drawing from the sources that they felt he was drawing from, and then he would sometimes cross out that source and write another source. This is from where I was bringing it from. And how much more so, he was very pleased when people would learn his teachings and look up those sources. Meaning, we took it as a matter of simple faith that the Rebbe was a great Torah biblical scholar. However, that didn't preclude or excuse us from our own personal intellectual responsibility to find out how did the Rebbe get to the points that he wanted to make. And in any great stage, in fact, one of the regrets that Rambam had in compiling his Mishneh Torah, which is basically his great work in Jewish law, is that he did not annotate from all the sources that he drew from the previous generations, including the Gemara, which angered a lot of rabbis in his generation, but subsequent generations, and in particular ours, that if you go to the Mishneh Torah by Rambam, it's filled with sources. So you see, on one page of law from Rambam, you might see 50 sources that he called from. Now, some of those books weren't published even in the time of the Rambam. Many of them were, and he gathered or collated in from the oral tradition that was existent at that time that he was able to access. So that's part of the process. If you have a very, very good question, fine. But ask yourself, what is motivating your question? Are you motivated by the thirst and desire to increase your awareness? Or are you trying to play like you want to be the new king of the road, the new big shot, to try to push your viewpoint on other people, when people you might be interacting with have many, many, many more years of scholarly research and they in discussion with other scholarly people or even lay people? Because, you know, we have a teaching from our sages, from I have learned from one source more than others, my students, because a sharp student will actually sharpen his teacher, who might tower over him or her, or she, her knowledge might tower over their particular student by the fact that the student is dedicated to the teaching. Also applies to secular studies as well. The teacher who is able to engage his students to the point where students are actually able to learn the material and ask those good, hard questions, because there's certain gaps in their own knowledge, not to try to undermine the teachings, the teacher's viewpoint, but rather to get to the truth of the matter, whether it be a matter concerning the Torah or a scientific or a mathematical or English grammatical point. Dennis?
Yes. Is it your ego or is it your thirst for the truth that will motivate a question? Because most humans, when you ask a question, there's always a kernel of another question behind it. And that is the learning process that we do. If we can't answer our own question, we ask others to help us to understand. But that doesn't mean that the answer to the question is really the answer. It means that's the best that the person can do. So we are limited, but that doesn't mean we give up. But we always try to learn something new. And questions are the mode or the medium to use. So if you're honest in your questions, that you probably can use, and think of the next question.
I think there's just one more point I want to make. It's about 30 plus years now that I've been learning Torah, that I found that it is good to ask the question when you just simply don't understand the simple, say if you're learning a translation from the Hebrew to the English, or even if the English word troubles you, it's good to ask those simple questions. What does this mean? Not why does it mean it? That's the second level of learning, but that has to be built on your understanding. What does the teaching mean? And I have found that many times what seemed to be, for that moment, a burning question, I put it back on the stove to keep warm, and then usually sometimes by the middle or the end of the class or even the next class, my question was answered. So rather than take up the time of the teacher and to take up the time of other students who might be learning at a quicker pace than myself, I've learned that it's been a healthy self-regulating behavior on my part to only ask a question, first of all, if there's something in the basic meaning I will admit to I don't understand. And once you start to build your knowledge base in what I don't or what you don't understand, Blessels, you'll find that your learning of scripture or the oral Torah traditions or in secular matters becomes a much more pleasurable, edifying, self-nurturing, empowering experience. Dennis, I'll leave you with the last word on that.
Unanswered questions bounce around in our human minds. They'll come out at some point in time. When we don't expect it, or when we do it on a planned basis. But unanswered questions are an irritation underneath our skins that doesn't give us any relief. You must follow the questions that are in your head. You cannot say, oh, forget about that because I'm going to change everything I'm thinking about and I'm going to change it to something else. Wrong. Unanswered questions stay with us until we get some type of explanation. And if we don't like the explanation, we consider that unanswered. So unanswered questions keep on going. But that was the whole idea of free will that was given to us, that we must seek and find the answers. It's all a question then of what is your motivation? Do you want to know the truth or not?
True. Des, I know I want to leave you with the last note, but I'm just, you know, it's just something that I'm trying to keep from within myself. I don't, but I'm afraid I'm going to burst it out in another part of the program. It will seem more tangential. I just want to mention, Blizzles, I remember reading a story of one sage from the 18th century where he actually took him 20 years to find the answer to his question. And even in certain Talmudic tractates, there's a statement called teku, meaning the issue was unresolved by the sages of those days, learning that piece of oral Torah tradition. And guess what? So they said it's a teku, meaning we're going to have to wait for someone of the likes and stature of Elijah the prophet to answer our question. So, you know, what Dennis said is right, but sometimes, you know, not even the teacher knows the answer. And if it's a really good question, you'll follow up with it, not just by asking the teacher, but doing your own research, and then hopefully you'll find it. And then that will be in itself an experience of how to learn and how to share that awareness with other human beings. With that being said, yes, Dennis.
Well, I got to burst out with this like you just burst out with that. No, really, I have this this part of the Guide to Perplexed that I'm going to read over the air, and it touches on the same subject, which is unbelievable, because we didn't coordinate this before the program began.
Well, We see the divine hand that's embedded within synchronicity. So we'll get to that in a couple of minutes, Dennis. And I'm sure bless those of you out there listening live, or you'll be hearing the archive version. Should keep your ears in tune to what Dennis will share with us in a few moments. But now we're going to move to our next segment of our program, the Book of Genesis. And we're going to kind of piggyback off last week's verse, which was chapter 7, verse 2. Of all the clean animals you shall take for yourself, 7 pairs, a male and its mate. And of the animals that are not clean, 2, a male and its female. So we talked about last week that one of the things that we can learn out from that, the clean animals were not just, they were just physically clean, or they were self-cleaning, but rather we're talking about animals which were designated to enter the ark, which would eventually be offered up, as some of them, as an offering by Noah and his children eventually, and also eventually by the patriarchs of Israel and the nation of Israel, and even for the devotees of the traditions of the children of Noah, which are the 7 universal commandments, which we'll be talking about a little bit later on. So verse 3 in chapter 7 is, again, springing off what we learned about the 7 pairs of clean animals, male and female, and the animals that are not clean, 2, a male and its mate. So chapter 7, verse 3 reads as, also of the fowl of the heavens, meaning the birds, 7 pairs, male and female, to keep seed alive on the face of the earth. And Rashi, the primary elucidator of the oral Torah tradition, wants us to know that, again, this is referring to clean not in the sense of a physically cleaned, winged creature of the creation, but rather one which would eventually be suiting to be brought to the temple, and even pre-temple times, as an offering to the Most High. Now, there's another instruction that we can glean out from this, and from here I'm pulling out an inspiration from the Torah anthology based on this verse. And here the Torah is teaching us the lesson that one should never say anything improper. This is not speaking of obscenity. That is obvious, and no allusion should be required. In fact, one of our great sages, Rav Bachya, warns that speaking just vulgar language is something which is very unfitting, so unbecoming to the human living experience. But rather, what we should try to learn out from this is that whenever a person speaks, he or she, they should be careful that each word should not be improper. So we see here that, and again, these scriptural verses that I read just now, which were dictated to Moses by the Most High in a prophetical fashion, we see even that, as it's understood from the oral Torah elucidation, we see even that God was careful not to use a derogatory word. Instead of calling these animals unclean, meaning animals that would not be suitably offered up as animal sacrifices, he said, every animal that is not clean, using an additional 3 words, so as not to use a derogatory word. Of course, the Torah does use the word unclean in many places, but that's referring to when, say, although he doesn't cite here, that, like, for instance, according to the laws of Israel, when a Israelite or a Jewish person becomes unclean, the word is tamei, meaning they might have touched a dead person, which, of course, the touching of a dead person to prepare them for death is certainly a very praiseworthy act of kindness towards the person who needs to be laid to rest. Whether the things that are spoken about, whether it be untimely discharges from the place of procreation in the male or female, even after the woman gives birth, in our tradition and the instructions of Moshe, the written oral Torah, when a woman, after she gives birth, because she discharges blood or during her menstrual cycle, is called unclean. But it doesn't mean that she's dirty. It's just that we're talking about there's been a certain occurrence which the Torah identifies as that, as being tamei or unclean. One other thing that there's a Talmudic teaching that says that a person's character is evident from the way he or she speaks. The Talmud relates that 2 students were analyzing a difficult text, and one said, quote unquote, I'm as tired as a bushed pig. The other disciple remarked, I'd rather say, as a bushed kid. All the first one meant was that he was very weary from analyzing an extremely difficult Torah text, since he wished to understand it perfectly. but since he used the pig as a simile, his master refused to speak to him anymore. The master also remarked that one who refrained from mentioning an unclean animal would end up as a great sage, and his words came true. Now, I want to make a caveat before I ask Dennis to comment on this. We're talking about a very, very high level of analytical study. The fact that the Torah speaks of two students who were analyzing a difficult test, meaning these were not just regular Torah students. These were people on a very, very high level of learning. So when a person is considered in the realm of being scholarly, truly scholarly in written oral Torah traditions, there's a certain conduct that's expected of him and even of her, because we do see there have been many great scholarly women, not to be sexist. A Jewish woman or a daughter of Noah can be great scholarly figures and can teach scripture and oral and written Torah traditions to many people, as long as they've put in their time. They've spent the hours and hundreds of hours, and for many great sages, thousands upon thousands of hours of learning in order to elucidate. So I just want to put a caveat on that, you know, because I know today even if we see that amongst the Jewish people, and I'm sure it goes among all people, sometimes a person eats too much food and they say, I pigged out. Well, we're not going to hold the same level of strictness in saying this person, because he said that, is now never going to become, if he or she truly desired to become a person of great understanding of such teachings as we are presenting on today's program. Dennis?
Yes, the word clean conjures up a lot of different ideas, Don, and that's
right.
Why you were trying to differentiate between the different levels. But the ultimate level of clean is purity. That is the absence of anything that would make it unclean. In other words, we have a better understanding of the negative side of the word than we do of the positive side. Because what pure means to one person may not mean the same thing to the other. In other words, if you take something that you believe is dirty and you clean it, scrub it, put Ajax, Comet, and everything on it, are you making it pure? Where does purity come into this? That's why sometimes when women actually give birth for the first time, and this goes back in Scripture, they have to be purified in some case. But they did nothing wrong. All
right.
That they did was produce a baby of some type, which was the natural order of things.
That's
so
right.
When we use the word purity there, we don't mean it the same thing as clean. We mean reset. We're going to reset it so it goes back to what we believe is its original purpose. Now, is that pure? Is that clean? I don't know. We can debate this till doomsday. But that's immaterial. All as I remember when I was a kid, if you said curse words, too many curse words, the parents would say, you keep that up and I'm going to wash your mouth out. So here we are saying curse words and bad language. We're going to actually put soap in your mouth to clean your mouth out, hoping that you won't say any more curse words. Yet the curse words come from your mind, your mouth delivers them. So if you want to go after the messenger, that's fine. But the source, again, is what are you motivated to convey in the language where you are cursing? Because in the English dictionary, it quite clearly states, a curse word is not transferring any information to the people who hear it. So you are using sounds that do not convey information. So what are you doing? You're trying to express your frustration by making sounds? Well, all sounds are not language. You make a grunt or you keep saying Are you transmitting any information? No. So from a logical viewpoint, curse words do not convey information. It may tell people around you that you're upset, frustrated, fine, but that's your problem. By yelling out the curse words doesn't transfer it to them. So therefore, if you can't self-contain and control your emotions, you could end up uttering curse words from here to kingdom come, and whenever you feel mad or disturbed, irritated. You're going to express your feelings without information. Now, this is a silly idea and a strange concept, but humans still do it because we are not always rational. So you can be as irrational as you want to and curse, but you're not transferring any information. So pure, clean and unclean are things that get bounced around a lot. So we expect you to speak clearly so you transfer information. So the question of clean or unclean language does not come out because it has no logical function in the language. It becomes a personal expression that you're trying to impose on other people.
True. Dennis, this could be a whole discussion because anger management is related as well to the idea of using unseemly words in our human language. But I think you encapsulated so many points. I just hope that our listeners, whether listening live or eventually when they'll hear the archive version, will take to heart what you said and work on learning to better express their emotions. As they say, there's many ways to skin a fish, and there's two sides of the coin. But let's remember, you know, it's a fish is still a fish, and a coin is still a coin, and you are still you. Whether you express it properly or improperly, you have to learn how to deal with yourself. And hopefully, as all of us, I should say, not just you, meaning someone who's listening and trying to get too personal with them, but all of us have to deal with our intellect, deal with our emotions, deal with our desires, and learn to sublimate them for the higher cause. And we find that when we're able to, it's more pleasurable to be able to sublimate it, even though in the initial training process, which is part of the human living experience, that it might seem painful at times, but when we feel a sense of satisfaction because we actually felt something which gripped us, and yet we were able to sublimate it to a higher cause, well, we see that we're getting a little bit more aware of who we truly are, which is beings who are human and all configured to our divine image. With that being said, we're going to move on to Proverbs chapter 3, verse 25, which, again, I have to say is kind of piggybacking off. Well, look at the word I'm using. Piggyback is riding off of. Riding off of the previous verses where King Solomon, the author of Proverbs, is encouraging students of Torah not to let the Torah depart from your eyes, spiritual and physical. Guard the wisdom and what that will provide a grace for you and a source of life for your soul and help you to go around securely, and that you should be not surprised when you lie down, not fearing, and your sleep will be sweet, even if you encounter what is known as the human experience of nightmares. Chapter 3, verse 25 is also in continuation of the previous ideas, which King Solomon writes to us as an eternal transmission for the human family experience. Be not afraid of sudden terror or the darkness of the wicked when it will come. Now, unfortunately, we had a horrible example of sudden terror in Paris, France, last week. But King Solomon wants us to know that even in those moments, and I can tell you, blessings, I have been in a situation where I've had to evacuate a bus in Israel where there was suspicion of a bomb being there. I was there in 1991 when Saddam Hussein aimed one of 39 Scud missiles into Israel, and I remember the sounds of the air raid sirens and how we were bolstered at that time by the teaching of the Lubavitcher Rebbe that Israel was the safest place in the world. And in fact, the 39 missiles did about $10 billion of damage. But the truth be known, and I have to this is something that the Rebbe always encourages to do, that of those 39 Scud missiles, there was only one Jew who died, even though I personally saw an 8-story building that after, a couple of days after it was down by one of the Scud missiles, crumbled like a, I didn't see it crumble, but I saw the aftermath of the rubble, and not one person was killed. One of my wife's cousins had their house, the front of the side of their house destroyed by a Scud missile on a Friday night, where lo and behold, they weren't in the house to be damaged. They were actually involved in the communal prayers of the Saturday night. So King Solomon says, as another sort of perk, again, no one who makes an assertion in the Torah can say this covers 100% of any scenario for any person 100% of the time, but the Torah speaks in the majority of instances. So when there seems to be some act which is terrifying, King Solomon saying, if you really have true faith in the Most High and you are totally immersed in Torah study and prayer and acts of kindness, that you will not be afraid in times of terror, and even if that terror comes suddenly. And in terms of, or the darkness of the wicked one will come, we're talking about, heaven forbid, not upon the victims who were brutally slaughtered last Friday night. We're talking about the darkness that fell upon the wicked, those wicked human beings who perpetrated. Now, we don't exactly know what happens when a person leaves this world, but I cannot really promote the ideology in any way, shape, or form that because of their particular beliefs at that particular time last Friday night, did they really think they were going to heaven? Did they really think they were going to be submerged or immersed in all the delights of this world, even though when they were shot, basically they're no the human soul is leaving the body? Did those people really think that all the pleasures they were denied in this world will be granted in the next world because they have killed so many innocent people, people they may never have met, people who might have been eventually become their friends if they had given them the chance? So King Solomon is talking about that type of person. Heaven forbid to cast any aspersions upon the victims. No, they were innocent. The ones who did that who spilled all that blood, who got involved in all that unnecessary carnage, they are the wicked ones, and they are the ones. And the darkness that they're encountering, who knows what they're going through, but I can't believe they're in the light of God's kindness and gratitude for what they did last Friday night. Dennis?
Yes. There is no good that comes out of evil. So if you go ahead and you kill other people, is that a reason for you to go to heaven? When terror or fear strikes any human, the first thing that comes into our mind is a quick prayer, because all of a sudden we remember that our God is merciful and we put our future in his hands. And the quickest way to activate that is to say a prayer. So instantly, whether you think the plane is going to crash rather than land, if you think you're standing on an earthquake and your ground is going to open up and you're going to fall in, if you think a mountain is going to fall on you, in a split second, you're going to remember a prayer and ask for some help for deliverance. Why? Because once you leave this planet, once you leave this earth, you are going someplace else. There are more unknown questions about that someplace, be it heaven or even the moon for that matter. It is not the same thing. So when that fear builds up, we turn to our maker, our creator, to help us out. Everybody does it, and that's the way it's going to be.
Thank you, Dennis. Now let's go to our point in today's presentation, where we're going to experience a little divine embodiment of synchronicity, which we also call Hashkacha Pratis, divine providence. And what would you like to share with us today, which should connect back to what we talked about early in the program, according to the teachings?
As I read it, you'll hear the connection. So it's okay. The guide for the perplexed page, online version 465, chapter 31. And this is what I live for in Mayamati's teachings. You get a certain amount of peace involved, and you don't find that in all writings. So let me read. There are persons who find it difficult to give a reason for any of the commandments, and consider it a right to assume that the commandments and prohibitions have no rational basis whatsoever. They are led to adopt this theory by a certain disease in their soul, the existence of which they perceive, but which are unable to discuss or describe. For they imagine that these precepts, if they were useful in any respect, and were commanded because of their usefulness, would seem to originate in the thought and reason of the same of some intelligent being. But as things which are not objects of reason and serve no purpose, they would undoubtedly be attributed to God, because no thought of man could have produced them.
According to the theory of those weak-minded persons, man is more perfect than his creator. For what man says or does has a certain object, whilst the actions of God are different. He commands us to do what is of no use to us and forbids us to do what is harmless. Far be this, and this is exclamation mark at the end of this. On the contrary, the sole object of the law is to benefit us. Thus we explain the scriptural passage, quote, for our good always, that he might preserve us alive as it is this day, unquote. Deuteronomy 6:24. Again, quote, which shall hear all those statutes, hunkenim, and say surely that the great nation is wise and understanding people, close quote. That is Deuteronomy 4:6. Thus he says that every one of these statutes, in quotes, convinces the nation of the wisdom and the understanding it includes. But if no reason could be found for these statutes, if they produce no advantage and remove no evil, why then should he who believes in them and follows them be wise, reasonable, and so excellent as to raise the admiration of all nations? Question mark. But the truth is undoubtedly, as we have said, that every one of the 613 precepts serves to inculcate some truth, to remove some erroneous opinion, to establish proper relations in society, to diminish evil, to train in good manners, or to warn against bad habits. All this depends on three things: opinions, morals, and social contact. We do not count words, because precepts, whether positive or negative, if they relate to speech, belong to those precepts which regulate our social conduct, or to those which spread truth, or those which teach morals. Thus, these three principles suffice to assigning a reason for every one of the divine commandments.
Beautiful, Dennis. And yes, it definitely connects back to what we talked about before. And again, blessed souls, those of you who have heard this live version, hopefully you can go back to when this program will be uploaded into the archive version. Those of you who haven't heard it yet will be hearing on the archive version this type of teaching again, with the profundity of the Nesher Gadol, the great Igor Rambam, certainly warrants for those who have heard it live or will hear it in the near future, hopefully, to review the teaching, think about it, draw inspiration, grow with it, be nurtured by it. And then when the moment strikes you and motivates you, with the blessings of the Most High, to share it with another person. We're now going to move on to our next section, blessed souls. We're touching on a very, very deep point, which is connected to the settling of human society, making it more stable. We're talking about the idea of one is able to merit to marry off one's child. What is the attitude one can adopt? And this is under the umbrella, the concept of Erech HaPaim, having patience, being long in anger, because certainly there can be a lot of frustration, anxiety connected to the marrying off of one's kin. And sometimes people try to prevent it. But the short point we want to share today from the wisdom gleaned from the teachings of Rabbi Nachman and various, excuse me, just take a sip of coffee here for a second. I have to lubricate my throat because these teachings and interacting with Dennis is something which really stokes the fire within me. And I have to cool down that passageway, which allows me to be able to share my thoughts with you, blessed souls. Anyway, so, excuse me, Rabbi Nachman wants us to know that many times that the parent, when in the process of marrying off their son or daughter, feel compelled to spend a tremendous amount of money in the marriage of their children, which from one perspective it's very understandable. It could be an only child, it could have many children, and the person could be blessed with a lot of money. But Rabbi Nachman wants to remind us that we sometimes also have to restrain ourselves, because marrying a child for the sake of just aggrandizing oneself is a vanity, and it also is a type of, again, we're talking within the perspective of a Torah, viewpoint, it's really a kind of like an evil spirit to marry one's children to aggrandize themselves or to self-aggrandize ourselves. Because someone who wants to show off their wealth and their honor, to spend lots of money on all different types of vanities, it would be better to, again, this is the suggestion of Rabbi Nachman, and I know that within the Jewish community there have been many rabbis who've talked about it. Lubavitch Rebbe talked about it. The Ger Rebbe talked about it. It'd be better to make a wedding for the children, like the custom of the poor. Now, again, excuse me, one should consult with a wise person, rabbinical or not, what would be the, I would suggest, the middle ground. But Rabbi Nachman is saying, as a counterbalance to the arrogance of just wanting to self-aggrandize myself, he's saying, in that context, it would be better to treat the preparations and the actualization of the wedding to conduct oneself as a poor person, to sort of humble themselves. Now, they still might spend a lot of money relative to what most average people or poor people would spend, but it would be better, if they were going to spend a lot of money towards the wedding, to use that money to actually set up the children, one's daughter, one's son, with one's future son-in-law, one's future daughter-in-law. It'd be better to spend a greater amount of money so that in the next several months or the next year, they can get off on the right start in terms of the establishment of their home, not to spend an inordinate amount of money on the wedding and then kind of, so to speak, leave the newly formed couple high and dry, bereft of the things they really need. For whatever reason, the parent could spend a lot of money on the wedding, but in terms of helping them with their upkeep of their first year of marriage until they really get their feet on the ground, to if they haven't established forms of stable income, which still in the Jewish community, this has happened more than one occasion, that when a young couple marry, that the first year the husband will go off to a rabbinical seminary for married men for a year, meaning he'll still live at home with his newly wedded bride, but it would be better to spend the money either to help them establish their new home after the wedding, or to refrain from just sinking in so much money. I mean, I can tell you a story that my mother told me. She attended a wedding, and it was a wedding by which the mother and father of the bride spent $50,000 on flowers, and my mother said to me, she herself was embarrassed that another member of the family would waste so much money on flowers, which are, you know, what's the life of a flower? A week? 2 weeks? 3 weeks? Maybe? So, Dennis, your take on this, on the balance. I mean, I know you've married off at least one child, if not more than one. The balance parents have to have, and again, this is a Jewish Torah perspective, but I think it has a universal application in terms of how parents have to use a measuring stick of, is it really about their children's happiness, or is it about self-aggrandizing themselves in the process of marrying off their children?
This goes back to the word on a human level, Don, that's called sufficient. What would suffice to have a pleasant, nice, happy wedding? Mm-hmm. What is sufficient? Is there a number in it that would produce this? Is there a dollar sign with how many zeros after it would make a difference? These two people who are wedding are setting up their future. It's their future that we're celebrating. It's not the event that the parents have grown these children for. It is a wedding has nothing to do with the parents because the parents' future is behind them. That doesn't mean their entire future is wiped out. It just means that they had the responsibility when they bring humans into the world to the duty and responsibility to grow them as adults, and they'll behave like good people. And what we expect to see at a wedding is a lot of warmth, love, hugging, and kisses. That's why we tinkle the glasses, because we want to see those people kiss each other, because it's a joyous occasion. It's not occasion, not a financial occasion. It's not a banking occasion. It's not a question of, I have more shekels in my pocket than you do. No, it's a question, how are they prepared for the future and how are they going to go about it? So we wish them well, and it's a joyous thing. If the parents have done their job, then the two people who are getting married should understand that, because now they're imitating their parents to a certain extent. So if the parents are overjoyed by the occasion, then the wedding is not for the parents, which they think it is because they're spending so much money. It's for the kids to enjoy. So the idea of using the excess, more over the sufficient amount, to be used for the future has more logical common sense application. Now, you would think this would be expressed by the parents and the children before the wedding, so everything is planned and goes along like life is a bowl of roses, a bowl of cherries. But we must remember that we have to only do what is sufficient. If you go overboard, you're going to change the balance of things. And in human terms, we don't feel comfortable when that happens. We can look at it and say, oh, these people are getting their egos in the way, when in effect, it should be pure human love.
Beautiful. Now we're going to move on to the next section, Chabad Chasidus, and we're going to start a new presentation, which I'm gleaning. It's strictly in Hebrew. I don't think this has been translated to English yet, so this is perhaps, although we've shared some of this material, I think, in past programs, going back over the past 5.5 years, little bits and pieces, I felt this would be a fitting addition to our humble efforts here in this particular presentation in search of ancient authentic Torah, talking about, when we talk about man, which also is inclusive of woman, so anything we'll be learning in this section of this presentation, hopefully in future shows of the Blessings of the Most High, we're including inclusive of women. So there are basically 11 ways in this particular presentation within the Hasidic traditions of Chabad Chasidus, and this was put together by Rav Yochanan, who himself is considered to be one of the great scholarly elucidators of the branch of Chabad Chasidus, who used to stand very close to the Lubavitch Rebbe, and with his mind he was like a tape recorder. And he basically wants us to understand there are basically 11 ways that we can look at 11 contexts by which to look at a human being. And I'm just going to read them, and then hopefully next week we'll start to go into each one of these 11 contexts, starting with context 1 and moving on until we get on to context. Actually, it's 8 contexts, actually. I said 11. It's really 8 contexts from which to understand how we can understand a human being. The first one is the essence and the categorization, the boundaries of a human being, and how all the boundaries and matters of a person have a certain unity within that human being. Number 2, how a person, just as we have a right arm, a left arm, and a middle trunk to our body, how in spiritual terms, how a person has a certain inclusiveness from a right side perspective, a left side perspective, and a middle perspective, how a human being includes from all different types of levels within the creation, how a human being is a master of free choice, how a person can exercise his or her experience to have some sort of dominion and rulership over their own personal lives, and sometimes that can actually extend over to them becoming actual leaders among people, whether communal leaders, city leaders, state leaders, national leaders, international leaders. The idea that a person has the sensitivity, if he or she chooses to feel the essence of who they are as a human being in not a narcissistic, negative way. The next one is, actually, this is all part of context number 1. These are sub-contexts. How a person is a speaking being, how a person is an intellectual being, how a person has an inner content to him or herself, how a person is capable of great change. So that's context 1. Context 2 is there is a before and after type of presentation of a human being, which we'll get into it when we merit to get to that point. How context number 3, how a person can receive from different elements of the creation and then have an effect on different elements of the creation. Context number 4, a person's purpose and their service in this world. Context 5, the manifestation of a creation of a human being and the time and how that relates to time and the way that they are as human beings. Context number 6 is the idea that every human being has a body and soul. which is distinguished from all different types of creations, meaning our body and our souls are different than an animal body and animal soul. The fact that a human being in context number seven contains, we all contain within ourselves elements of inanimate matter, vegetative matter, animal matter, and that which makes us human. And the eighth context, actually there were 11 contexts, excuse me, I'm sorry, I don't have my glasses on. The eighth context is why do we bear this name of Adam or man, which also includes woman. Context number nine is there are four general levels of a human being, which will better be explained when I translate it into the from the Hebrew to English. But basically, I'm just going to say them in Hebrew, and then we'll get to at that proper time to explain each one according to what's being implied to that level of human. Adam, Ish, Gever, and Enosh. Context number 10 is the term by which we can be identified as a speaking entity, which makes us, although animals speak, the way in which a human speaks is quite unique in relation to other creations known as the animal kingdom or the those beings which are in the aquatic atmosphere, the water, the fish and the reptilian creatures and the sea plankton and whatever things you want to describe as existing and living underneath the waters of the world. And the last context is how a human being is likened to a tree. So, Dennis, I'm pretty excited about hopefully in the future we're going to go slowly and hopefully methodically into these 11 categorizations of human being. Again, not to ultimately define what we are, but to, again, to push the envelope to encourage human beings to think a little bit more of we're more than just the pants that we wear and the shirt that we wear or the makeup we may put on or the iPhone that we own or the possessions that we own. We are a complex being that was manifested in or created and revealed into creation by an infinite creator. So we have a lot of unique nuances, and perhaps if we come to discover our unique nuances as human beings, we'll get great appreciation of the one who spoke and we came into being. Your take on these matters?
Well, it sounds like an empirical study of what God put together called a human being, Don. We are not simple objects. We are not simple entities. We are very, very complex because we have sides, and that is we have a physical side and we have a mental side. Part of the mental side is dealing with the natural and the so-called supernatural or spiritual world. So to try to put them into a little shoebox is very hard to do because there's so many different variations to so many different humans that we have to be careful of how we categorize things because sometimes we will we don't know the intention of Hashem, our creator, as to why he put us together other than to operate so that we could eventually end up in heaven. So to me, it's those things that you need to control and use as a human to get to heaven that are the most important. And to me, one of the things that really centers on the human, each human personally, do you know yourself? Do you know what you're supposed to be doing? Do you know your capabilities? Are you exercising them? And how do you grade yourself? How do you understand what you're doing, if it makes sense, and you should continue to do it? Now, again, this is looking at the empirical side of the human being, but from a different viewpoint. But we're talking about the same thing, I believe, Don.
Yes, and again, I mean, I'm sure even Rokan, because it's only about 48, 49 pages of elucidations here, and certainly there's more to be written, and there was more, and there was written historically about the human being, their purpose, whether from a secular, philosophical viewpoint, anatomical, biological viewpoint, chemistry, or even physics perspective. But again, it's to hopefully heighten our appreciation of who we are as human beings. With that being said, we're now going to enter our last segment of today's program, which I'm very excited to share this particular piece here. Again, we're reading from The Theory and Practice of Universal Ethics, the Noahide Laws, put together, written by Rabbi Dr. Shimon David Cowan. And let's go right into it. In this segment, in the introduction to the book, Rav Cowan wants us to know the following. Buddhism is in turn a derivative of Hinduism, incorporating many of its seminal spiritual notions. While Buddhism has also often been portrayed as a religion which is not theistic, it actually displays a quote-unquote negative route to the same transcendent deity. In the words of a contemporary writer, quote, Buddhism does not require focus on relationship with God, but it shares recognition that unhealthy attachment to things that are not God are at the root of human sufferings. And there he quoted from Christopher Cook's Substance Abuse, which was printed in 2009, from either it's a periodical or a book called Spirituality and Psychiatry, published by RC Psych Publication, 2009, page 147. And also the co-writers of this article or researchers was C. Cook, A. Powell, and A. Sims. In line with this, there is a meditation used in certain contemporary psychological therapies whereby, quote, a power outside of oneself is identified, a power greater than self, which is not self. It is not so much that is what is asked to believe in God as they must believe that they are not God. And that's quoting from the Australian Constitutional Convention, 2nd to 13th of February, 1998, a transcript of proceedings. An Australian politician seeking a multi-faith resonance with the words, quote-unquote, humbly relying on the blessing of Almighty God, to the preamble of the act establishing the Australian Constitution, states that he discussed this with the Dalai Lama. Quote, I asked the Dalai Lama about the concept of Almighty God, and he said, quote-unquote, at the end of the day, it is the same supreme being. Those were their words, which the Australian politician asserted were stated by the Dalai Lama. Hence, traces of Abrahamic Noahide theology are to be found in both Eastern religions, as in the Occidental religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. However, differently, the former developed. Together with this common spiritual heritage comes the ability to hear a common set of root values, which in their pure original expression are the Noahide laws. And we'll end on this final, very fascinating point, that in the present world, the adherents of Christianity and Islam, as noted, constitute 55% of the world's inhabitants. And there, Rav Cohen quotes from a website, which you can go to, Blessed Souls, it's called www.adherence.com. That's www.adherence.com. And these faiths, religions, Christianity and Islam, have a strong background in the Abrahamic, Noahide, and biblical traditions. The adherents of Hinduism and Buddhism constitute another 21% of the world's population. As mentioned, traces of the same ancient affinity with Abraham's teachings are found in them also. Consequently, in total, 76 of the world's populations have a connection with Abrahamic approach or teaching of the Noahide laws. So I like this, Dennis, because it really brings together the idea that there is more in common with the major religions of the world than the media or just commonly held by people on the street. They say there's a disconnection, but here we see there's a common thread running through all of them. Your thoughts on the matter?
The common thread is
we were all created by the same creator. We were all made in the same type of image. We were all put together for the same purpose on the planet. We were not designed to be alone. So therefore, inherent in our being and all the people who walked upon the earth before we were born, this common thread of humanity is there. Sometimes we forget that there is a bond between humans. And there are people who are trying to say that the difference between humans is more important than what we have in common. We have the same blood. It may be different types, but it is generally the same blood. The same parts of our organs are there. So if you look at the inside of a body, could you tell that this person is different from the other one? By what? If you don't understand their mind, the physical bodies are quite similar. So therefore, but we're different from other animals. But that is a common bond that's there. And when you look at another human You don't look at it as though the other human is alien. You recognize it as a human. You may not know how to approach it, how to treat it, how to discuss, get along with it, but there is a bond because it's another human. You distinguish that human from another animal. We put animals in a zoo. We don't put animals, we don't put humans in zoos. We put humans in houses, in apartment houses. And we go about it as though that's common sense. So common sense creates a bond between humans. How we go about it after that is what you brought up, is what politics say, what's the difference. The media and everything else like that, they want to say that it's more important for you to think about our differences. Why? What, will the differences bring about good things? Or can you rely on what the Creator designed for the common bond between people?
Thank you, Dennis. And I'm thinking, too, and I want to thank you for those potent words. And, of course, I want to thank you for using one of your most valuable resources that you have while living upon this blessed earth, your valuable time, for spending the last plus hour with myself. I just want to mention, before you make your concluding statement for today's humble efforts, that I was thinking, you know, as you were speaking, Dennis, how, you know, yeah, under the microscope, who can tell? But even where we can get down to the nitty-gritty details of DNA, to and genes, where we can recognize certain patterns which identify one person as being part of a nation or a culture, that we have to remember the thread which connects all forms of DNA and genetic research. It is all human genes and it's all human DNA. And the fact that there are differences between one nation and another in terms of their DNA uniqueness or their genetic uniqueness, well, that's, again, that's testimony, I think, ultimately to the glory of our Creator, who just doesn't make one thing that represents, you know, which is replicated in robotic fashion. Each human being, each member of the human family experience bears a uniqueness, which is not to separate one people from another, one nation from another, or now we, religious or ethnocentric manner, to distinguish one people from another, one culture from another, one religion from another, one faith from another, but rather testimony where our Creator can go on in infinite ways to create infinite types of variation, which is supposed to beautify the creation, not be a source of discord, hatred, jealousy, unwarranted competition, and unfortunately, bloodshed as well. So what would you like to conclude with today, Dennis, before we sign off?
All life is built on one unit of structure called a cell. We are all made of a bunch of cells. And you know what? They're all identical. So if you got a bunch of cells, you have a built-in identity. You cannot deny it. It's there. So just say a prayer that bonding, even just the physical bonding alone, has value. And it will prevail because that was what the designer or creator had in mind.
Thank you, Dennis, again, and bless us all. We're about to end off, of course, with our program-ending segue music by David Dohm. Will help us back get back home. Today's song will be To See Us to the Day, but until we see that day that we need to see, we'll be led to by the Creator. Let's remind each other time after time. Let it be our mantra. We've got to do good. And even though that might generate ambivalence or anxiety, that's okay, because at least you're being in touch with your feelings, how you feel about doing good. But I just want you to know, blessed souls, that we have a tradition in Israel, which is not only for the Israelites, but for all the kol bo olam, all the inhabitants of the world. Hateva tov leheitiv. It's the nature of the good to do good, and the good here we're talking about, alluding to, hinting to, and now we're going to talk about directly, is the Creator, who in his ultimate form of goodness, which is way behind any human type form of goodness, he gave us life. And may we continue to see the manifestations of the life from the Creator in a way to help us to see us to the day. And this will be accentuated in the song I'm about to play for you by David Dohm to help us internalize and realize our Tzelem Elohim has no dream. Our divine image will help us get up in scrimmage. And may this all be accomplished the way of Ahavachad, one love, Goralachad, one destiny, calling for all of us. Badarchi Noam, in a pleasant way, Darchi Shalom, in a peaceful way, Laham Sheikh Bez Hashem Yisprik, to be continued with the help of the Most High. Take care, everyone.
Thank you.